Coventry Archives Service Oral History Unit, this is Francis Good, and I'm interviewing Margot Miles in Tennant Creek on the 20th of October 1994. This is the beginning of DAT tape number one. All right, Margot, we can start recording now. Could you just tell us, first of all, for the sake of the tape, your full name and your date of birth and where you were born?
It's Margot Sylvia Miles. I was born in 1910. And I was born in Geelong, in Victoria.
Right. And did you grow up in that area?
No. My father was at the war and my mother moved to Adelaide and stayed there. She really came from Mount Gambier, but things weren't so wonderful as they are now then. And of course, she had to go out and earn a living when we lost our father. So we grew up in Adelaide, which is a very nice place.
And when did you come to the Territory and why did you come?
Oh, well, I come about 1932. And I worked in John Martin's in Adelaide making school uniforms. Do I talk loud enough?
That's fine.
And but, of course, things were in the middle of a depression then. And so they could only apply, girls for 2 days a week, which you got about 10 shillings a day. And so I seen the advertisement in the paper wanting a housekeeper for a new building in Tennant Creek. So I had to go to a street in Harney Street, who were wine merchants, to be interviewed. And luckily I was selected. So £10 they gave me to get to Alice Springs. So I was very worried because I never had a pair of shoes. It was only cardboard soles in them. But I had some money over after I booked on the train, which was the GAN, one of the first trips. So I bought a pair of shoes for 7 and 6, which worried me all the way up to Alice Springs because I'd spent the firm's money.
Could you tell me what it was like to travel on the GAN in those days?
Well, it was very hard, but it was most enjoyable. There was no sleeping arrangements. It was carriages, and those old-fashioned carriages had seats running straight up the carriage, and they stopped at different stops, and you could always get hot water at the engine driver and give you the hot water when you stayed, and you could, if you had a billy can, that is, you'd go out there and get a billy of water and put some tea in it. But they had different stops, like Port Augusta, different stops like that, but very an Oodnadatta, they stayed there, and you could walk over the hotel and get a meal, but there was no food at all on the train. You kind of had to carry it with you. And it was a very good type of people because they were all bush people. And
what was it like when you got to Alice Springs? What happened there?
At any rate, there was a man there to meet me who he went looking for me and found me. He was a mailman from Alice to Tennant. And he was used the most bad language I'd ever heard of in my life because I was horrified. But it didn't matter because it was an open, it had no cover over it at all and only had a windscreen on it. And all he said was keep your bloody hat on all the time to me, you see. And he told me these anthills was Aboriginal graves, you know. And it was beautiful country, all was wild then, you know, no made roads at all. It was just rock and bull dust. And if you wanted to, I was frightened to ask him if I could get out and go to the toilet, you know, but I had to in the finish, you know, and he gave me strict orders what to do and what not to do when I was there. Now I'm old, I think of it and I laugh about it, you know. He was a married man, his wife was in Alice Springs. We got to Barrow Creek and we had a meal there.
What was at Barrow Creek in those days?
A hotel, same man that built the Tennant Creek one. He also built one somewhere else, but it was knocked down. Of course, they're marvellous buildings, you know, because they're still standing. It's only the people that buy them now that knock half of them down. And we had something at Barrow Creek. They're all built on the same principle. Beautiful concrete floors. And then in the night time, after a very rough ride, we arrived in the creek. And the boss... Alex Scott, his name was. He was waiting up for us. And he cooked me some bacon and eggs and he looked me over, you know. And he said, "Do you drink alcohol?" And I said, "No." Lucky for me, because my mother would never allow that, you know. She was a very strict woman. And told me where to sleep. £2.10 a week you get, he said, and everything found. Of course, I already knew that. I thought it was a fortune, you know. And next morning I was awake and looked out, and there's a thousand goats out there, out in the street. It was as rough, you know, but these goats, they were looking through the mosquito netting. But I could hear these men talking, you know, and they said, "Did the new girl arrive?" And they said, "What's she like?" They said, "She's pretty skinny." Something to that effect. Anyway, I had to get up and get help, get the breakfast. Never knew where a thing was or anything. But 4 shillings a meal it was. Bacon and eggs, porridge, toast, everything. Really, it was a beautiful dining room.
Yeah, could you describe the hotel for me, what it consisted of and so on?
It had 3 bedrooms and a big, beautiful billiard room and the kitchen. Of course, in those days, there was no refrigeration, anything like that. You kind of had Coolgardie safes, which, you know, had wet hessian draped over it, and that kept it cool. But people never seemed to notice that, you see. But all their gear came up on big trucks about once a fortnight or a month. Mostly consisted of potatoes and pumpkins. That's the only thing that carried, really, but there was no refrigeration.
So you're saying the meat was mostly corned beef?
Yes. There was no butchers in the town. But later on, their man that ended up in Parliament, he used to go out the ute and shoot cattle and carve it up out there and bring it back and sell it from the back of the ute. And, of course, they had to cook it immediately because there was no way of doing it anyway. But the corned beef, they used to dry salt. Beautiful corned beef, you know. And hang it, of course. You hung it and it could last you 6 months. All the stations did the same thing. But as time went on, of course, the butcher came there and made sausages and everything.
Well, that was very modern for you.
Yes. But the cooks, you see, they were bush cooks. And they knew what to do. They had no toasters in those days. You stood in front of a roaring fire and toasted on a fork. No one seemed to take any notice. Of course, they hadn't lived in more... The towns were more modern, the cities, you see, and they hadn't experienced that. Because to go into that country then, that was a very rough living. But mostly men it was, you know, looking for gold.
Well, how long were you actually working at the hotel then?
Well, I thought I worked there from 10 to 15 years, but I can't remember now, you know. But I worked there for a long while. Camille worked at one period. Her husband had a gold mine out in the honeymoon. I suppose she told you all of that anyway. But different women that came into the town that didn't have any money. There's not many single women there, you know, but there was hundreds of men. Of course, women begin to think they were Greta Garbo or Marilyn Monroe. They had that much attention paid to them, you see. And a lot of married women, a lot of people came from across Wyndham Way. Oh, well, they came from... Most of the men was over 50, between 50 and 60. They were old prospectors. They came from Palmerston River and everywhere because they had their... Out of there was a gold to find there.
Now, who actually owned the pub when you first arrived?
Jack Noble.
Can you tell me about him? What sort of man was he?
He was the skinniest man out. And he was just like leather, you know. But he was a wonderful man, really. He came from Derby in Western Australia, and he used to break horses over there. And they told me he used to ride his horses down, right down to the river, and there was cliffs, and the horse would fall, and Jack would jump, and the horse broke his back. He also owned a oxen team. He and this Alex Scott that managed the hotel, you know, that's how they first made their money, you see, carrying passes and everything to stations. They only had the oxen, as they called them, oxen teams. And they had big whips, and they used to crack their whips over them, you know. And then, of course, their horses came and they had trolleys in until the motor cars arrived. Of course, the motor cars, it wasn't country for motor cars. Too rough. Although today they've got the most beautiful roads in Australia through the territory, I think.
So, how long did Jack Noble actually own the pub?
He would have owned it for 7 years. Of course, he would have sold it only for Alex Scott. Of course, he wanted to sell it and Alex Scott wouldn't let him. Because he was his mate, you see, and he used to drink a lot, Jack. And he'd have only fed the money away, any rate, you know. Any rate, eventually they sold it to a chap named Ken Milne. He was a bookmaker in Alice Springs. And he paid $25,000 for it.
How much was that?
£25,000. Which was a big lot of money in those days, you know. What was that?
Off you go.
Oh. He was a bookmaker, yes. And he took off up to back to Palmerston Roads, Jack Noble. Of course, he did it around, you know. He used to ride a bike stuffed with spinny picks because he couldn't buy tyres and all this, you know. But he was a man that... he was more of a natural man than he didn't have much sense because he drank a terrible lot, you know. And Alex Scott stayed there for a while and went back to Derby, where he came from.
What sort of man was Alex Scott?
He was a communist. And he used to preach to me about communism, you see. And he used to get all the communistic papers. And there was about four men in Tennant Creek that had that in those days. They had that, they were mad on that collective farming that was very popular in Russia. And of course, they used to get the newspapers. Couldn't read Russian, of course. But there was a lot of men that really believed in that kind of thing, Australian men in those days, you know. And I always used to give them to me to read, of course. But of course, they had no toilet paper in those days, and I used to put them down the toilet. And that's how I knew all about collective farming, reading down there. And we used to use tissue paper that wrapped around apples and all that kind of thing, you know. But there was very few newspapers here because they had to come out from Alice Springs. They were old stuff at the time they got here, but everyone liked the newspapers. But he used to get the most. He had them posted to him, all these Russian newspapers. But I must add one thing that was very good about Tennant Creek Hotel. It had the biggest ladies' toilet. It was half as big as this room and half, you know. I don't know why that is, you know, because they had pans in those days and there was a big broad seat on it. But what happened there, what we used to do, the women that worked there, was the men used to get very drunk and they go home and thrash their wives. So we told the wives, you see, you come down here and we'll look after you. So we used to stow them in the toilet, of course, because the men used to come back and rage around looking for their wives and they'd never dreamed of looking in the toilet, you know. They used to bring their kids and a blanket and they'd camp there for the night. Of course, there wasn't many women that drank and there wasn't many women on the staff, so they had plenty of room. I don't know why he built the hotel. There was in each pub, they were so big, the toilets, ladies' toilets, you know. The men were just at the back of them.
There weren't ladies' toilets, there weren't very many of them in other places in Tennant Creek, though, were there?
None at all. Not a bit. Everyone was a duck behind. It was very hard, you know, when they used to have big dances in Tennant Creek and all the men used to go one way and the women the other. But the women used to have to go and sit down in the scrub. Of course, the men, they were all right, you see. All they'd do was pull a douse kind of business, but the women had to squat. I lost a dress on a thistle bush one night. I got up and left the dress behind. But they never catered for that kind of thing. And it was a great big dance hall, you know. Not a toilet inside.
You must have had a pretty good time in the dance hall, though.
Oh, wonderful. Because there was not many women there, you see. Men wasn't allowed to dance together in those days. But, wonderful. We used to have big balls, you know. Everyone was a good dancer. Jack Noble was the worst. But he'd come and do one of those Russian dances and they'd put him out because he used to swear when he fell over and all this business. But it was a community effort. It was done for the school It was done for different things. People used to get up, but there was a marvellous thing between everyone in the town. Everyone helped each other. If anyone's husband shot through, they'd go and get enough money to put them on the train and things like that, you know. Of course, they're marvellous people that live on coalfields are like that, I think. I went to Kalgoorlie once and they were just the same. I don't know about Mount Isa. I think it had a bigger population, you see, and it started in a different era than Tennant Creek. And everyone knew everyone in Tennant Creek. Anyway, when I got sick of working in hotels and having a laundry and that, I went to work at the paper shop, which was run by a little train, and the planes used to come in the middle of the night then, and they'd go out and get the papers and bring them back to me. And I used to say, I work at 4 o'clock in the morning and end about five at night, you know, but I liked it. But Jack Noble, by then, he'd gone through most of his money, and he came to me and said, Marg, he said, you got any money? I said, oh, yes. Do you want some? He said, yes. He said, how about lending me £20? I said, well, what's a good of lending to you, Jack? I said, because you'll go in the pub and shout everyone and drink, and that's the finish of it. No, he said, I'm going on my honeymoon. He said, this time? I said, you're not. He said, yes, I am. He said, I just won myself a gin. He said, and I want to buy a box of beer and a few blankets and take her out bush for a fortnight. Of course, I did see him in the fortnight's time, and he nearly died by the look of him. Certainly had a good honeymoon. Of course, he didn't take any food with him, so he used to have to go out and stab the rabbits with a stick, and the black gin would cook them for him. I didn't call that a honeymoon.
It's interesting that there were that many rabbits around even in those days.
Yes, and also there was here a very small wallaby, and it lived in the Honeymoon Range, you know. It was about now, it's not there now, about that lovely little thing.
So it'd only be about kind of knee-high.
Yes. Now, I have never seen one for years because the prospectors killed them all and ate them. See, they killed the big kangaroos, but these small wallabies, they were easy. They could throw a sharp stick and throw it and kill it. You see, the big ones, it takes more than that to kill them. And there was hundreds of them, but it's a shame. I think they just wiped them all out, you know. But there was rabbits here, and they killed all them too, because they didn't have any money to buy anything to eat. You see, they had flour. That was all. They could make a damper. But as far as meat was concerned, they lived off the land. But not any dingoes. They never had those. What they killed them for was their pelt, you know, and they tanned them up and laid them on camp floors. Beautiful. But they never ate them, you know. But I really think I've never seen a wallaby out on the Honeymoon Range for about 20 years. It's a shame. I don't know enough of them to know what their name was.
You were actually cooking for the mines at one stage too, weren't you?
Oh, yes. Nobby's Knob. I cooked out there, and I cooked out of different mines. But Nobby's Knob, they only aged hundreds of men. You see, that was a big contract. And another girl and I had, her name was Kit Fisher. And we made a lot of money out of it. I built a new house in Tennant Creek with it. And
so what were the facilities like out there at Nobby's Knob when you were cooking?
Very good. Big refrigeration. They had big stoves. Of course, they only 300 men. You see, you had to have three meals a day for 300 men.
Now, what years would this have been, roughly?
I forget it, to tell you the truth.
We're talking about post-war, are we? After the war?
After the war, yes. Mm. It would have been 10 years ago for me, any rate. Because other girls died since then. But it was an immense job, and we worked very hard. Mostly New Australians, you see, that they engaged, but they weren't miners, they were surface workers. But the real miners is a man, Paul Ruger, he's a mayor now, his father was a boss there. They were genuine miners. And, of course, used to pinch the gold. One of them had a dog trained there, and when the whistle would blow at 4 o'clock, the dog knew that was his master was going to knock off. So the dog would come and wait at the pit head, and this bloke would throw stones at him. Go home, you know. Get home, you mongrel. Nobody knew that was Victor Gold, he'd come up after Winter's Dark and collect them all. I thought that was very clever. But nobody knew at the time, you see. Yes, it was gold stealing at mines is not regarded as a crime amongst miners, you know, because they're not company-owned mines. They reckon they work hard enough to get all they can. That's in Tennant Creek. I don't know about anywhere else. I think other mines would have hundreds of men like Kalgoorlie or Mount Isa. They wouldn't get the, you know, they went down in a bucket for a long while in the Nobles Knob until they put the lift in, you know, to lower them down. And they used to put them in their lunch bags and everything fits of gold. Now and again, the management would go through all the camps and instead of them getting rid of it quickly, they'd just shack these stones under the bed. Any man found gold-bearing stone would be sacked.
Tell me about the living conditions for miners out on the mining camps.
Well, the ones that prospected for themselves wasn't too good because, you see, some of them, you know, they chased gold all their life. And when they found it, they were disappointed. They didn't want to do that, really, because they only went away and wasted it. But it was the searching for it, you see, that intrigued them and got them. And they always got up every morning and thought, today's the day, you know, I'll find it. They had to tell me about this. I think I'll find it today, Mark, they'd say. If they camped in the pub and we were out, they'd go. But there was a couple of really good finds. But the living quarters the real prospectors made, they were very good. They slung wire netting in boughs boughs of trees. And they had campfires. And always one was a cook. And if things were tough, the bloke that cooked the most, they'd send him out to get a job on the station. You see, because he could cook. Anyone that could cook bread was always got a job on a station in those days. And that's where he'd gather all the his wages. He might stop there for 3 months while the others was prospecting the field. But you see, prospecting has a fascination about it. Now, there's no prospecting goes on here now because they're all held by leases, which is a terrible thing, I think. But the prospecting and the finding the colour, that's what men live for. That type of man. It'd be horrified to some men, but they grew up on it and they loved it and they loved the camp life too, you know. They used to take all the beer back with them and all this business.
Yes, it seems for all the effort they went to get some to get gold and to have a find, that if they ever came into the money, they were pretty quick to spend it too.
Definitely, yes. Now, Alex Scott, he was a pretty good old bloke. There were a lot of old fellows prospecting, and of course they got so old they couldn't work anymore. So there was no pensions or anything in Tennant Creek. So what he'd done, there was about five of them. They lived on the veranda of the hotel, in ordinary beds. And underneath the mattress was their clothes. See, this is the time I worked there. And they were very respected men. Alex got, they had to sit at the head of the table. Any table they sat at, they sat at the head of the table. Because they'd grown old in the money that was circulating or making the town. Of course, they died eventually. The things on money made out of the book, I bought plaques and put them up in the cemetery because they were like fathers to me, you see, and they had no one. So I put them up there. It cost me about $1,000, and I thought they were well worth it to the respect, and they were old gold miners.
And they virtually had no other means of support, but they were being looked after.
Yes, by Alex Scott. He looked after them, he provided meals for them, and I washed their clothes. They only had a suitcase, you see, or a swag. And in the meantime, over the years, well, the pension, they got the pension, the different ones that grew older in the town. See, today the pensioners get a marvellous, I think, in this town. I don't know about the other towns in Northern Territory. I suppose they're all the same. They have a beautiful nursing home here, everything.
What is it about Tennant Creek that's made you stay here for all this time?
People, I think. I always think in myself that God must have smiled or put his hand down on just where Tennant Creek is. Because it's such a happy place, always has been. And people help each other all the time. And you walk up the street and everyone knows you. You walk up in the city and no one knows you. Everyone knows everyone, and if you don't know them, you stop and talk to them or say hello, or where do you come from? See, there are a lot of tourists here. And you kind of claim them, and they'll tell you. They're quite happy to talk to you. I was running the pensioners' bookstall in the main street, and they used to gather around and talk about where they'd been. They come from Alice Springs, and they come from Darwin, and how was it and all this. But it's a feeling of being wanted in a small town. I don't know about other places, I suppose. They are in the territory like that, are they? A community kind of... But they're all made welcome here.
You actually, from your book, it seems as if you fell in love with Tennant Creek from the moment you arrived.
Oh, definitely. Mostly with the naturalness of it. Beautiful sunsets and all these things in their wild state. No one ever thought of shooting anything. Much in those days, they had to shoot something to live, but the bird life was terrific. But people, of course, wiped that out themselves. You see, when Tennant Creek started, with all the wild things left. See how they wiped those little wallabies out. But they have to live, you see. Feels they want to be wanted, they should come in Tennant Creek, especially old people, you know. You see these nice flats they provide for everyone. And they take care of them marvellously, you know. And I've been away from three times from... I built myself a home in Port Douglas. And when the news come on about the weather in Northern Territory, I'd sit and cry. I was that homesick. So I sold the damn thing and came back again. Then I thought I was missing something out there, you know. So I did it again. Went back, and a mate of mine struck gold. He found Poseidon, Ken Shirley, you see. Well, he said, if you're so damn mad to get back there, I'll give you a house, which he did. He was married, of course. His wife was my mate. So he gave it to me, but I couldn't stand it, you know, again. I had to give it back to him. I said, I'm terrible sorry, you know. Of course, everyone that's been here has got some corner of their heart in Tennant Creek. I don't know whether it's because they enjoyed their young life here or they liked the people. It's something. I always think, because everywhere I go, and they know I'm from Tennant, they'll come and see me and ask me, how's this one, how's that one? I love it, even now. I've got my burial plot out there.